Dealey Francis, she says. Her eyes were as big and dark as plums. That's Roy. He's my husband. Are you going to kill us?
Johnny gave her a stern look and says, We are the Dillinger gang, Mrs. Francis, and we have never killed anyone.
Johnny always made this point. Harry Pierpont used to laugh at him and ask him why he wasted his breath, but I think Johnny was right to do that. It's one of the reasons he'll be remembered long after the straw hat-wearing little pansies forgot.
That's right, Jack says. We just rob banks, not half as many as they say. And who is this fine little man?
He chucked the kiddo under the chin. He was fat, all right. Looked like W.C. Fields. That's Buster, Dealey Francis says.
Well, he's a regular little bouncer, ain't he?
Jack smiled. There was blood on his teeth.
How old is he? 3 or so?
Just barely 2 and a half, Mrs. Francis says proudly.
Is that so?
Yes, but he's big for his age. Mister, are you all right? You're awful pale, and there's blood on your...
Johnny speaks up then.
Jack, can you drive this one into the trees?
He pointed at the carpenter's old Ford.
Sure,
Jack says.
Flat tire and all? You just try me. It's just that... I'm awful thirsty. Ma'am? Mrs. Francis? Do you have anything to drink?
She turned around and bent over, not easy with that horse of a baby in her arms, and got a thermos from the back. Another couple of cars went puttering by. The folks inside waved, and we waved back. I was still grinning fit to split, trying to look just as Homer as a Homer could be. I was worried about Jack and didn't know how he could stay on his feet, let alone tip up that thermos and swig what was inside. Iced tea, she told him, but he seemed not to hear. When he handed it back to her, there were tears rolling down his cheeks. He thanked her, and she asked him again if he's all right.
I am now, Jack says.
He got into the Hoodoo Ford and drove it into the bushes, the car jouncing up and down on the tire Johnny had shot out.
Why couldn't you have shot out a back when you goddamn fool?
Jack sounded angry and out of breath. Then he wrestled the car into the trees and out of sight and came back, walking slow and looking at his feet like an old man on ice.
All right, Johnny says.
He discovered a rabbit's foot on Mr. Francis's key ring and was working it in a way that made me know that Mr. Francis wasn't ever going to see that Ford again.
Now, we're all friends here, and we're going to take a little ride.
Johnny drove. Jack sat in the passenger seat. I squeezed in back with the Francises and tried to get the piglet to shoot me a grin.
When we get to the next little town, Johnny says to the Francis family in the back seat, we're going to drop you off with enough for bus fare to get you where you were going. We'll take the car. We won't hurt it a bit, and if no one shoots any bullet holes in it, you'll get it back good as new. One of us will phone you where it is.
We haven't got a phone yet, Dealey says. It was really a whine. She sounded like the kind of woman who needs a smack every second week or so to keep her tits up. We're on the list, but those telephone people are slower than cold molasses.
Well then, Johnny says, good-humored and not at all perplexed, we'll give the cops a call and they'll get in touch. But if you squawk, you won't ever get it back in running shape.
Mr. Francis nodded as if he believed every word. Probably he did. This was the Dillinger gang, after all. Johnny pulled in at a Texaco, gassed up, and bought soda pops all around. Jack drank a bottle of grape like a man dying of thirst in the desert, but the woman wouldn't let Master Piglet have his, not so much as a swallow. The kid was holding his hands out for it and bawling.
He can't have pop before his lunch, she says to Johnny. What's wrong with you?
Jack was leaning his head against the glass of the passenger window with his eyes shut. I thought he'd passed out again, but he says,
Shut that brat up, missus. Or I will.
I think you've forgotten whose car you're in, she says all haughty.
Give him his pop, you bitch, Johnny says.
He was still smiling, but now it was his other smile. She looked at him, and the color in her cheeks disappeared. And that's how Master Piglet got his knee high, lunch or no lunch. 20 miles farther on, we dropped them off in some little town and went on our way toward Chicago. "A man who marries a woman like that deserves all he gets," Johnny remarked. "And he'll get plenty."
"She'll call the law," Jack says, still without opening his eyes.
"Never will," Johnny says, as confident as ever. "Wouldn't spare the nickel." And he was right. We saw only 2 blue beetles before we got into Chi, both going the other way, and neither one of them so much as slowed down to look at us. It was Johnny's luck. As for Jack, you only had to look at him to know that his supply of luck was running out fast. By the time we got to the loop, he was delirious and talking to his mother.
"Homer," Johnny says in that wide-eyed way that always used to tickle me, like a girl doing a flirt.
"What?" I says, giving him the glad eye right back.
"We got no place to go. This is worse than St. Paul."
"Go to Murphy's," Jack says without opening his eyes. "I want a cold beer. I'm thirsty."
"Murphy's," Johnny says. "You know, that's not a bad idea."
Murphy's was an Irish saloon on the south side. Sawdust, a steam table, 2 bartenders, 3 bouncers, friendly girls at the bar, and a room upstairs where you could take them. More rooms in the back where people sometimes met or cooled off for a day or two. We knew 4 places like it in St. Paul, but only a couple in Chi. I parked the Francis's Ford up in the alley. Johnny was in the back seat with our delirious friend. We weren't yet ready to call him our dying friend, and he was holding Jack's head against the shoulder of his coat.
"Go in and get Brian Mooney off the bar," Johnny says.
"What if he isn't there?"
"Then I don't know," Johnny says.
"Harry!"
Jack shouts, presumably calling for Harry Pierpont.
"That whore you set me up with has given me the goddamn clap."
"Go on," Johnny says to me, soothing his hand through Jack's hair just like a mother.
Well, Brian Mooney was there, Johnny's luck again, and we got a room for the night, although it cost $200, which was pretty dear considering the view was an alley and the toilet was at the far end of the hall.
"You boys are hotter than hell," Brian says. "Mickey McClure would have sent you right back into the street. There's nothing in the papers and on the radio but Little Bohemia."
Jack sat down on a cot in the corner and got himself a cigarette and a cold draft beer. The beer brought him back wonderful. He was almost himself again.
"Did Lester get away?"
he asked Mooney. I looked over at him when he spoke up and saw a terrible thing. When he took a drag off his lucky and inhaled, a little puff came out of the hole in the back of his overcoat, like a smoke signal.
"You mean Babyface?" Mooney asked.
"You don't want to call him that where he can hear you," Johnny said, grinning.
He was happier now that Jack had come back around, but he hadn't seen that puff of smoke coming out of his back. I wished I hadn't either.
"He shot a bunch of G's and got away," Mooney said. "At least one of the G's is dead, maybe 2. Anyway, it just makes it that much worse. You can stay here tonight, but you have to be gone by tomorrow afternoon."
He went out. Johnny waited a few seconds, then stuck his tongue out at the door like a little kid. I got laughing. Johnny could always make me laugh. Jack tried to laugh too, but quit. It hurt him too much.
"Time to get you out of that coat and see how bad it is, partner," Johnny said.
It took us 5 minutes. By the time he was down to his undershirt, all 3 of us were soaked with sweat. 4 or 5 times I had to put my hand over Jack's mouth to muffle him. I got blood all over my cuffs. There was no more than a rose on the lining of his overcoat, but his white shirt had gone half red and his undershirt was soaked right through. Sticking up on the left side, just below his shoulder blade, was a lump with a hole in the middle of it, like a little volcano.
"No more," Jack says, crying. "Please, no more." That's all right, Johnny says, running the palm of his hand through Jack's hair again. We're all done. You can lie down now. Go to sleep. You need your rest.
I can't, he says. It hurts too much. Oh, God, if you only knew how it hurts. And I want another beer. I'm thirsty. Only don't put so much salt in it this time. Where's Harry? Where's Charlie?
Harry Pierpont and Charlie Makeley, I guessed. Charlie was the Fagin who'd turned Harry and Jack out when they weren't no more than snot noses.
There he goes again, Johnny says. He needs a doc, Homer, and you're the boy who has to find one.
Jesus, Johnny, this ain't my town.
Doesn't matter, Johnny says. If I go out, you know what's going to happen. I'll write down some names and addresses.
It ended up being just one name and one address, and when I got there, it was all for nothing. The doc, a pill roller whose mission was giving abortions and acid melts to erase fingerprints, had happied himself to death on his own laudanum 2 months before. We stayed in that cheesy room behind Murphy's for 5 days. Mickey McClure showed up and tried to turn us out, but Johnny talked to him in the way that Johnny had. When he turned on the charm, it was almost impossible to tell Johnny no. And besides, we paid. By the fifth night, the rent was $400, and we were forbidden to so much as show our faces in the tap room for fear someone would see us. No one did, and as far as I know, the cops never found out where we were during those 5 days in late April. I wonder how much Mickey McClure made on the deal. It was more than a grand. We pulled bank jobs where we took less. I ended up going around to half a dozen scrape artists and hairline changers. There wasn't one of them who'd come and look at Jack. Too hot, they said. It was the worst time of all, and even now I hate to think about it. Let's just say that me and Johnny found out what Jesus felt like when Peter Pilate denied him 3 times in the Garden of Gethsemane. For a while, Jack was in and out of delirium, and then he was mostly in. He talked about his mother and Harry Pierpont, and then about Booby Clark, a famous fag from Michigan City we'd all known.
Booby tried to kiss me, Jack said one night over and over until I thought I'd go nuts.
Johnny never minded, though. He just sat there beside Jack on the cot, stroking his hair. He'd cut out a square of cloth in Jack's undershirt around the bullet hole and kept painting it with mercurochrome, but the skin had already turned gray-green and a smell was coming out of the hole. Just a whiff of it was enough to make your eyes water.
That's gangrene, Mickey McClure said on a trip to pick up the rent. He's a goner.
He's no goner, Johnny said.
Mickey leaned forward with his fat hands on his fat knees. He smelled Jack's breath like a cop with a drunk, then pulled back.
You'd better find a doc fast. Smell it in a wound, that's bad. Smell it on a man's breath.
Mickey shook his head and walked out.
Fuck him, Johnny said to Jack, still stroking his hair. What does he know?
Only Jack didn't say nothing. He was asleep. A few hours later, after Johnny and I had gone to sleep ourselves, Jack was on the edge of the bunk, raving about Henry Claudy, the warden at Michigan City. I God Claudy, we used to call him because it was always, I God I'll do this and I God you'll do that. Jack was screaming that he'd kill Claudy if he didn't let us out. That got someone pounding on the wall and yelling for us to shut that man up. Johnny sat next to Jack and talked to him and got him soothed down again.
Homer? Jack says after a while.
Yes, Jack, I says.
Won't you do the trick with the flies? He asks.
I was surprised he remembered it.
Well, I says, I'd be happy to, but there ain't no flies in here. Around these parts, flies ain't in season just yet.
In a low, hoarse voice, Jack sang,
There may be flies on some of you guys, but there ain't no flies on me. Right, Chumma?
I had no idea who Chumma was, but I nodded and patted his shoulder. It was hot and sticky.
That's right, Jack.
There were big purple circles under his eyes and dried spit on his lips. He was already losing weight. I could smell him, too. The smell of piss, which wasn't so bad, and the smell of gangrene, which was. Johnny, though, never gave no sign that he smelled anything bad at all. "Walk on your hands for me, John," Jack said, "like he used to." "In a minute," Johnny said. He poured Jack a glass of water. "Drink this first. Wet your whistle. Then I'll see if I can still get across the room upside down. Remember when I used to run on my hands in the shirt factory? After I ran all the way to the gate, they stuck me in the hole." "I remember," Jack said. Johnny didn't do no walking on his hands that night. By the time he got the glass of water to Jack's lips, the poor bugger had gone back to sleep with his head on Johnny's shoulder. "He's gonna die," I said. "He's not," Johnny said. The next morning I asked Johnny what we were going to do, what we could do. "I got one more name out of McClure, Joe Moran. McClure says he was the go-between on the Bremer kidnapping. If he'll fix Jack up, it's worth $1,000 to me." "I got $600, I said. "And I'd give it up, but not for Jack Hamilton." Jack had gone beyond needing a doctor. What Jack needed by then was a preacher. I did it for Johnny Dillinger. "Thanks, Homer," he said. "I'll be back in an hour. Meantime, you mind the baby." But Johnny looked bleak. He knew that if Moran wouldn't help us, we'd have to get out of town. It would mean taking Jack back to St. Paul and trying there. And we knew what going back in a stolen Ford would likely mean. It was the spring of 1934, and all three of us, me, Jack, and especially Johnny, were on J. Edgar Hoover's list of public enemies. "Well, good luck," I says. "See you in the funny pages." He went out. I mooned around. I was mighty sick of the room by then. It was like being back in Michigan City, only worse. Because when you were in stir, they'd done the worst they could do to you. Here, hiding out in the back of Murphy's, things could always get worse. Jack muttered. Then he dropped off again. There was a chair at the foot of the cot with a cushion. I took the cushion and sat down beside Jack. It wouldn't take long, I didn't think. And when Johnny came back, I'd only have to say that poor old Jack took one final breath and just copped out. The cushion would be back on the chair. Really, it would be doing Johnny a favor. Jack, too. "I see you, chumma," Jack says suddenly. I tell you, it scared the living hell out of me. "Jack," I says, putting my elbows on that cushion, "how you doing?" His eyes drifted closed. "Do the trick with the flies," he says, and then he was asleep again. But he'd woken up at just the right time. If he hadn't, Johnny would have found a dead man on that cot. When Johnny finally did come back, he practically busted down the door. I had my gun out. He saw it and laughed. "Put away the bean shooter, pal, and pack up your troubles in your old kit bag." "What's up?" "We're getting out of here, that's what." He looked 5 years younger. "High time, wouldn't you say?" "Yeah." "He been all right while I was gone?" "Yeah," I said. The cushion lying on the chair had "See you in Chicago" written on it in needlework. "No change?" "No change." "Where are we going?" "Aurora," Johnny said. "It's a little town upstate. We're going to move in with Volney Davis and his girlfriend." He leaned over the cot. Jack's red hair, thin to start with, had started falling out. It was on the pillow and you could see the crown of his head, white as snow. "You hear that, Jack?" Johnny shouts. "We're hot now, but we're going to cool off quick. You understand?" "Walk on your hands like Johnny Dillinger used to," Jack said without opening his eyes. Johnny just kept smiling. He winked at me. "He understands," he said. "He's just not awake, you know?" "Sure," I said. On the ride up to Aurora, Jack sat against the window, his head flying up and then thumping against the glass every time we hit a pothole. He was holding long, muttery conversations with folks we couldn't see. Once we were out of town, me and Johnny had to roll down our windows. The smell was just too bad otherwise. Jack was rotting from the inside out, but he wouldn't die. I've heard it said that life is fragile and fleeting, but I don't believe it. It would be better if it was. "That Dr. Moran was a crybaby," Johnny said. We were in the woods by then, the city behind us. "I decided I didn't want no crybaby like him working on my partner. But I wasn't going to leave without something." Johnny always traveled with a .38 pistol tucked into his belt. Now he pulled it out and showed it to me, the way he must have shown it to Dr. Moran. I says, "If I can't take away nothing else, Doc, I'll just have to take your life." He seen I meant business, and he called someone up there. "Volney Davis." I nodded, as if that name meant something to me. I found out later that Volney was another member of Ma Barker's gang. He was a pretty nice fella. So was Doc Barker. And Volney's girlfriend, the one they called Rabbits. They called her Rabbits because she dug herself out of prison a few times. She was the best of the lot. Aces. Rabbits, at least, tried to help poor old troublesome Jack. None of the others would. Not the pill rollers, the scrapers, the face artists, and certainly not Dr. Joseph Crybaby Moran. The Barkers were on the run after a botched kidnapping. Doc's ma had already left, gone all the way to Florida. The hideout in Aurora wasn't much. 4 rooms, no electricity, a privy out back. But it was better than Murphy's saloon. And like I say, Volney's girlfriend at least tried to do something. That was on our second night there. She set up kerosene lamps all around the bed, then sterilized a paring knife in a pot of boiling water. "If you boys feel pukey," she said, "you just choke it back until I'm done." "We'll be okay," Johnny said. "Won't we, Homer?" I nodded, but I was queasy even before she got going. Jack was laying on his stomach, head turned to the side, muttering. It seemed he never stopped. Whatever room he happened to be in was filled with people only he could see. "I hope so," she says. "Because once I start in, there's no going back." She looked up and seen Doc standing in the doorway. Volney Davis, too. "Go on, Baldy," she says to Doc, "and take 'em heap big chief with you." Volney Davis was no more a Indian than I was, but they used to rib him because he was born in the Cherokee Nation. Some judge had given him 3 years for stealing a pair of shoes, which is how he got into a life of crime. Volney and Doc went out. When they were gone, Rabbits turned Jack over and then cut him open in an X, bearing down in a way I could barely stand to look at. I held Jack's feet. Johnny sat beside his head, trying to soothe him, but it didn't do no good. When Jack started to scream, Johnny put a dish towel over his head and nodded for Rabbits to go on, all the time stroking Jack's head and telling him not to worry. Everything would be just fine. That Rabbits. They call them frails, but there was nothing frail about her. Her hands never even shook. Blood, some of it black and clotted, come pouring out of the sunken place when she cut it. She cut deeper and then out came the pus. Some was white, but there was big green chunks which looked like boogers. That was bad. But when she got to the lung, the smell was 1,000 times worse. It couldn't have been worse in France during the gas attacks. Jack was gasping in these big whistling breaths. You could hear it in his throat and from the hole in his back, too. "You better hurry up," Johnny says. "He's sprung a leak in his air hose." "You're telling me," she says. "The bullet's in his lung. You just hold him down, handsome." In fact, Jack wasn't thrashing much. He was too weak. The sound of the air shrieking in and out of him kept getting thinner and thinner. It was hotter than hell with those lamps set up all around the bed, and the stink of the hot oil was almost as strong as the gangrene. I wished we'd thought to open a window before we got started, but it was too late by then.
Rabbits had a set of tongs, but she couldn't get them in the hole.
"Fuck this," she cried, and tossed them to one side, and then stuck her fingers into the bloody hole, reached around until she found the slug that was in there, pulled it out, and threw it to the floor.
Johnny started to bend over for it, and she said, "You can get your souvenir later, handsome. For now, just hold him." She went to work packing gauze into the mess she'd made.
Johnny lifted up the dish towel and peeked underneath it.
"Not a minute too soon," he told her with a grin. "Old Red Hamilton has turned a wee bit blue." Outside, a car pulled into the driveway. It could have been the cops for all we knew, but there wasn't nothing we could do about it then.
"Pinch this shut," she told me and pointed at the hole with the gauze in it. "I ain't much of a seamstress, but I guess I can put in half a dozen."
I didn't want to get my hands anywhere near that hole, but I wasn't going to tell her no. I pinched it shut, and more watery pus ran out when I did. My midsection clenched up, and I started making this gurk, gurk noise. I couldn't help it.
"Come on," she says, kind of smiling. "If you're man enough to pull the trigger, you're man enough to deal with a hole."
Then she sewed him up with these big looping overhand strokes, really punching the needle in. After the first two, I couldn't look.
"Thank you," Johnny told her when it was done. "I want you to know I'm going to take care of you for this."
"Don't go getting your hopes up," she says. "I wouldn't give him one chance in 20.
"He'll pull through now," Johnny says.
Then Doc and Volney rushed back in. Behind them was another member of the gang, Buster Daggs or Drags, I can't remember which. Anyway, he'd been down to the phone they used at the city's service station in town, and he said the G's had been busy back in Chicago, arresting anyone and everyone they thought might be connected to the Bremer kidnapping, which had been the Barker gang's last big job. One of the fellas they took in was John J. Boss McLaughlin, a high mucky-muck in the Chicago political machine. Another was Dr. Joseph Moran, also known as the Crybaby.
"Moran will give this place up just as sure as shit sticks to a blanket," Volney says.
"Maybe it's not even true," Johnny says. Jack was unconscious now. His red hair lay on the pillow like little pieces of wire.
"Maybe it's just a rumor."
"You better not believe that," Buster says. "I got it from Timmy O'Shea."
"Who's Timmy O'Shea, the Pope's butt wiper?" Johnny says.
"He's Moran's nephew," Doc says, and that kind of sealed the deal.
"I know what you're thinking, handsome," Rabbit says to Johnny, "and you can stop thinking it right now. You put this fella in a car and go bumping him over those back roads between here and St. Paul. He'll be dead by morning."
"You could leave him," Volney says.
"The cops show up, they'll have to take care of him."
Johnny sat there, sweat running down his face in streams. He looked tired, but he was smiling. Johnny was always able to find a smile.
"They'd take care of him all right," he says, "but they wouldn't take him to any hospital. Stick a pillow over his face and sit down on it, most likely."
Which gave me a start, as I'm sure you'll understand.
"Well, you better decide," Buster says, "because they'll have this joint surrounded by dawn. I'm getting the hell out."
"You all go," Johnny says. "You too, Homer. I'll stay here with Jack."
"Well, what the hell," Doc says. "I'll stay too."
"Why not?" Volney Davis says. Buster Daggs or Drags looked at them like they was crazy, but you know what? I wasn't surprised a bit. That's just the effect Johnny had on people.
"I'll stay too," I says.
"Well, I'm getting out," Buster says.
"Fine," Doc says. "Take Rabbits with you."
"The hell you say," Rabbits pipes up. "I feel like cooking."
"Have you gone cuckoo?" Doc asks her. "It's 1 o'clock in the morning and you're in blood right up to the elbows."
"I don't care what time it is, and blood washes off," she says. "I'm making you boys the biggest breakfast you ever ate. Eggs, bacon, biscuits, gravy, hash browns."
"I love you. Marry me," Johnny says, and we all laughed.
Oh, hell, Buster says. If there's breakfast, I'll hang around.
Which is how we all wound up staying put in that Aurora farmhouse, ready to die for a man who was already, whether Johnny liked it or not, on his way out. We barricaded the front door with a sofa and some chairs and the back door with the gas stove, which didn't work anyway. Only the wood stove worked. Me and Johnny got our Tommy guns from the Ford and Doc got some more from the attic. Also a crate of grenades, a mortar, and a crate of mortar shells. I bet the Army didn't have as much stuff in those parts as we did.
Well, I don't care how many of them we get, as long as that son of a bitch, Melvin Purvis, is one of them, Doc says.
By the time Rabbits actually got the grub on the table, it was almost the time farmers eat. We took it in shifts, two men always watching the long driveway. Buster raised the alarm once, and we all rushed to our places, but it was only a milk truck on the main road. The G's never came. You could call that bad info. I call it more of John Dillinger's luck. Jack, meanwhile, was on his not-so-merry way from bad to worse. By mid-afternoon of the next day, even Johnny must have seen he couldn't go on much longer, although he wouldn't come right out and say so. It was a woman I felt bad for. Rabbit seen new pus oozing out between those big black stitches of hers, and she started crying. She just cried and cried. It was like she'd known Jack Hamilton her whole life.
"Never mind," Johnny said. "Chin up, beautiful. You did the best you could. Besides, he might still come around."
"It's 'cause I took the bullet out with my fingers," she says. "I never should have done that. I knew better."
"No," I says, "it wasn't that. It was the gangrene. The gangrene was already in there."
"Bullshit," Johnny said, and looked at me hard. "An infection, maybe, but no gangrene. There isn't any gangrene now."
You could smell it in the pus. There wasn't nothing to say. Johnny was still looking at me.
"Remember what Harry used to call you when we were in Pendleton?"
I nodded. Harry Pierpont and Johnny were always the best of friends, but Harry never liked me. If not for Johnny, he never would have taken me into the gang, which was the Pierpont gang to begin with, remember? Harry thought I was a fool. That was another thing Johnny would never admit or even talk about. Johnny wanted everyone to be friends.
"I want you to go out and wrangle up some biggins," Johnny says. "Just like you used to do when you was on the Pendleton mat. Some big old buzzers."
When he asked for that, I knew he finally understood Jack was finished. Flyboy was what Harry Pierpont used to call me at Pendleton Reformatory when we were all just kids and I used to cry myself to sleep with my head under my pillow so the screws wouldn't hear. Well, Harry went on and rode the Lightning in Ohio State, so maybe I wasn't the only fool. Rabbits was in the kitchen cutting up vegetables for supper. Something was simmering on the stove. I asked her if she had thread, and she said I knew goddamn well she did, hadn't I been right beside her when she sewed up my friend? "You bet," I said, "but that was black, and I wanted white. Half a dozen pieces about so long," and I held out my index fingers maybe 8 inches apart. She wanted to know what I was going to do. I told her that if she was that curious, she could watch right out the window over the sink.
"Ain't nothing out there but the privy," she says. "I got no interest in watching you do your personal business, Mr. Van Meter."
She had a bag hanging on the pantry door, and she rummaged through it and came out with a spool of white thread and cut me off 6 pieces. I thanked her kindly and then asked if she had a Band-Aid. She took some out of the drawer right beside the sink because, she said, she was always cutting her fingers. I took one, then went to the door. I got in Pendleton for robbing wallets off the New York Central line with that same Charlie Makeley. Small world, ain't it? Ha! Anyhow, when it comes to ways of keeping the bad boys busy, the reformatory at Pendleton, Indiana was loaded. They had a laundry, a carpentry shop, and a clothes factory where the dubs made shirts and pants, mostly for the guards in the Indiana penal system. Some called it the shirt shop, some called it the shit shop. That's what I drew.
and met both Johnny and Harry Pierpont. Johnny and Harry never had any problem making the day, but I was always coming up 10 shirts short or 5 pairs of trousers short and being made to stand on the mat. The screws thought it was because I was always clowning around. Harry thought the same thing. The truth was that I was slow and clumsy, which Johnny seemed to understand. That was why I played around. If you didn't make your day, you had to spend the next day in the guardhouse, where there was a rush mat about 2 feet square. You had to take off everything but your socks and then stand there all day. If you stepped off the mat once, you got your ass paddled. If you stepped off twice, a screw held you while another worked you over. Step off a third time and it was a week in solitary. You were allowed all the water you wanted to drink, but that was a trick because you were allowed only one toilet break in the course of the day. If you were caught standing there with piss running down your leg, you got a beating and a trip to the hole. It was boring. Boring at Pendleton, boring at Michigan City, I-God's prison for big boys. Some fellas told themselves stories. Some fellas sang. Some made lists of all the women they were going to screw when they got out. Me? I taught myself to rope flies. A privy's a damn fine place for fly roping. I took up my station outside the door, then proceeded to make loops in the pieces of thread rabbits had given me. After that, there was nothing to it except not moving much. Those were the skills I'd learned on the mat. You don't forget them. It didn't take long. Flies are out in early May, but they're slow flies, and anyone who thinks it's impossible to lasso a horse fly, well, all I can say is if you want a challenge, try mosquitoes. I took 3 casts and got my first one. That was nothing. There were times on the mat when I'd spend half the morning before I got my first. Right after I snagged him, rabbits cried out, "What in God's name are you doing? Is it magic?" From a distance, it did look like magic. You have to imagine how it appeared to her. 20 yards away, man standing by a privy throws out a little piece of thread at nothing so far as you can see, but instead of drifting to the ground, the thread hangs in midair. It was attached to a good-sized horsefly. Johnny would have seen it, but rabbits didn't have Johnny's eyes. I got the end of the thread and taped it to the handle of the privy door with the Band-Aid. Then I went after the next one. And the next. Rabbits came out to get a closer look, and I told her that she could stay if she was quiet, and she tried, but she wasn't good at being quiet, and finally I had to tell her she was scaring off the game and send her back inside. I worked the privy for 1.5 hours, long enough that I couldn't smell it anymore. Then it started getting cold, and my flies were sluggish. I'd got 5. By Pendleton standards, that was quite a herd, although not that many for a man standing next to a shit house. Anyway, I had to get inside before it got too cold for them to stay airborne. When I came walking slowly through the kitchen, Doc, Volney, and rabbits were all laughing and clapping. Jack's bedroom was on the other side of the house, and it was shadowy and dim. That was why I'd asked for white thread instead of black. I looked like a man with a handful of strings leading up to invisible balloons, except that you could hear the flies buzzing, all mad and bewildered like anything else that's been caught at don't know how. "I be dog," Doc Barker says. "I mean it, Homer. Double dog. Where'd you learn to do that?"
"Pendleton Reformatory," I says.
"Who showed you?"
"Nobody," I said. "I just did it one day."
"Well, why don't they tangle the strings?" Volney asked.
His eyes were as big as grapes. It tickled me, I'll tell you that.
"Dunno," I says. "They always fly in their own space, and they don't hardly ever cross. It's mystery."
"Homer," Johnny yells from the other room. "If you got 'em, this would be a good time to get in here with 'em."
I started across the kitchen, tugging the flies along by their halters like a good fly cowboy, and rabbits touched my arm.
"Be careful," she says. "Your pal is going, and it's made your other pal crazy. He'll be better after. But right now, he's not safe."
I knew it better than she did. When Johnny set his heart on a thing, he almost always got it.
Not this time, though. Jack was propped up on the pillows with his head in the corner, and although his face was white as paper, he was in his right mind again. He'd come around at the end, like folks sometimes do.
"Homer,"
he says, just as bright as you could want. Then he sees the strings and laughs. It was a shrill, whistly laughter, not a bit right, and immediately he starts to cough. Coughing, laughing, all mixed together. Blood comes out of his mouth, some splattered on my strings.
"Just like Michigan City,"
he says, and pounds his leg. More blood now, running down his chin and dripping onto his undershirt.
"Just like old times,"
he coughed again. Johnny's face looked terrible. I could see he wanted me to get out of the bedroom before Jack tore himself apart. At the same time, he knew it didn't matter a fiddler's fuck. And if this was a way Jack could die happy, looking at a handful of roped shithouse flies, then so be it.
"Jack," I says, "you got to be quiet." "No, I'm all right now,"
he says, grinning and wheezing.
"Bring him over here. Bring him over where I can see."
But before he could say any more, he was coughing again, all bent over with his knees up and the sheets spattered with a spray of blood like a trough between them. I looked at Johnny, and he nodded. He'd passed beyond something in his mind. He beckoned me over. I went slowly, the strings in my hand, floating up, just white lines in the gloom, and Jack too tickled to know he was coughing his last.
"Let him go,"
he says in a wet and husky voice I could hardly understand.
"I remember."
And so I did. I let the strings go. For a second or two, they stayed clumped together at the bottom, stuck together on the sweat from my palm, and then they drifted apart, hanging straight and upright in the air. I suddenly thought of Jack standing in the street after the Mason City Bank job. He was firing his Tommy gun and was covering me and Johnny and Lester as we herded the hostages to the getaway car. Bullets flew all around him, and although he took a flesh wound, he looked like he'd live forever. Now he lay with his knees sticking up and a sheet filled with blood.
"Golly, look at him,"
he says, as the white strings rose up all on their own.
"That ain't all either," Johnny says. "Watch this."
He then walked one step to the kitchen door, turned, and took a bow. He was grinning, but it was the saddest grin I ever saw in my life. All we did was the best we could. We couldn't very well give him a last meal, could we?
"Remember how I used to walk on my hands in the shirt shop?" "Yeah, don't forget the spiel,"
Jack says.
"Ladies and gentlemen," Johnny says, "now in the center ring for your delight and amazement, John Herbert Dillinger."
He said the G hard, the way his old man said it. The way he had said it himself before he got so famous. Then he clapped once and dived forward onto his hands. Buster Crabbe couldn't have done it better. His pants slid up to his knees, showing the tops of his stockings and his shins. His change came out of his pockets and rattled away across the boards. He started walking across the floor that way, limber as ever, singing
"Tra-ra-ra-boom-dee-ay"
at the top of his voice. The keys from the stolen Ford fell out of his pocket, too. Jack was laughing in these big, hoarse gusts, like he had the flu, and Doc Barker and Rabbits and Volney, all crowded in the doorway, were also laughing, fit to split. Rabbits clapped her hands and called,
"Bravo! Encore!"
Above my head, the white threads were still floating on, only drifting apart a little at a time. I was laughing along with the rest, and then I saw what was going to happen, and I stopped.
"Johnny," I shouted, "Johnny, look out for your gun. Look out for your gun."
It was that goddamn .38 he kept tucked into the top of his pants. It was working free of his belt.
"Huh?"
he said, and then it dropped onto the floor on top of the keys and went off. A .38 isn't the world's loudest gun, but it was loud enough in that back bedroom, and the flash was plenty bright. Doc yelled and Rabbit screamed. Johnny didn't say nothing, just did a complete somersault and fell flat on his face.
His feet came down with a crash, almost hitting the foot of the bed Jack Hamilton was dying in. Then he just lay there. I ran to him, brushing the white threads aside. At first I thought he was dead, because when I turned him over there was blood all over his mouth and his cheek. Then he sat up. He wiped his face, looked at the blood, then looked at me.
"Holy shit, Homer, did I just shoot myself?"
Johnny says.
"I think you did," I says.
"How bad is it?"
Before I could tell him I didn't know, Rabbits pushed me to the side and wiped away the blood with her apron.
She looked at him hard for a second or two, and then she says, "You're all right. It's just a scrape." Only we seen later, when she dabbed him up with the iodine, that it was actually two scrapes. The bullet cut through the skin over his lip on the right side, flew through maybe 2 inches of air, then it cut him again on the cheekbone right beside his eye. After that, it went into the ceiling, but before it did, it plugged one of my flies. I know that's hard to believe, but it's true, I swear. The fly lay there on the floor in a little heap of white thread. Nothing left of it but a couple of legs.
"Johnny," Doc says, "I think I got some bad news for you, partner." He didn't have to tell us what it was. Jack was still sitting up, but now his head was bowed over so far that his hair was touching the sheet between his knees. While we were checking to see how bad Johnny was hurt, Jack had died. Doc told us to take the body to a gravel pit about 2 miles farther down the road, just past the Aurora town line. There was a bottle of lye under the sink, and Rabbits gave it to us.
"You know what to do with this, don't you?"
she asks.
"Sure,"
Johnny says.
He had one of her band-aids stuck on his upper lip, over that place where his mustache never grew in later on. He sounded listless, and he wouldn't meet her eye.
"Make him do it, Homer," she says, then jerked her thumb toward the bedroom where Jack was laying wrapped up in the blood-stained sheet. "If they find that one and identify him before you get clear, it'll make things just so much worse for you. Us too, maybe."
"You took us in when nobody else would," Johnny says, "and you won't live to regret it." She gave him a smile. Women almost always fell for Johnny. I thought this one was an exception because she was so businesslike, but now I seen she wasn't. She just kept it all business because she knew she wasn't much in the looks department. Also, when a bunch of men with guns are cooped up like we were, a woman in her right mind doesn't want to make trouble among them.
"We'll be gone when you get back," Volney says. "Ma keeps talking about Florida. She got her eye on a place in Lake Weir."
"Shut up, Vol," Doc says and gives him a hard poke in the shoulder.
"Anyway, we're getting out of here," he says, rubbing the sore place. "You ought to get out, too. Take your luggage. Don't even pull in on your way back. Things can change in a hurry."
"Okay," Johnny says.
"At least he died happy," Volney says. "Died laughing."
I didn't say nothing. It was coming home to me that Red Hamilton, my old running buddy, was really dead. It made me awful sad. I turned my mind to how the bullet had just grazed Johnny and then gone on to kill a fly instead, thinking that would cheer me up. But it didn't. It only made me feel worse. Doc shook my hand, then Johnny's. He looked pale and glum.
"I don't know how we ended up like this, and that's the truth," he says. "When I was a boy, the only goddamn thing I wanted was to be a railroad engineer."
"Well, I'll tell you something," Johnny says. "We don't have to worry. God makes it all come right in the end."
We took Jack on his last ride, wrapped up in a blood-stained sheet, and pushed into the back of that stolen Ford. Johnny drove us to the far side of the pit, all bump and jounce. When it comes to rough riding, I'll take a Terraplane over a Ford any day. Then he killed the engine and touched the band-aid riding his upper lip. He says,
"I used up the last of my luck today, Homer. They'll get me now."
"Don't talk like that," I says.
"Why not? It's true."
The sky above us was white and full of rain. I reckoned we'd have a muddy splash of it between Aurora and Chicago,
Johnny had decided we should go back there because the feds would be expecting us in St. Paul. Somewhere, Crows was calling. The only other sound was the tick-tock of the cooling engine. I kept looking into the mirror at the wrapped-up body in the back seat. I could see the bumps of elbows and knees, the fine red spatters where he'd bent over, coughing and laughing at the end.
"Look at this, Homer," Johnny says and points to the .38, which was tucked back in his belt.
Then he twiddled Mr. Francis's key ring with the tips of his fingers where the prints were growing back in spite of all his trouble. There were four or five keys on the ring besides the one to the Ford and that lucky rabbit's foot.
"Butt of the gun hit this when it come down," he says. He nodded his head. "Hit my very own lucky piece. And now my luck's gone. Help me with him."
We lugged Jack to the gravel slope. Then Johnny got the bottle of lye. It had a big brown skull and crossbones on the label. Johnny knelt down and pulled the sheet back.
"Get his rings," he says, and I pulled them off.
Johnny put them in his pocket. We ended up getting $45 for them in Calumet City, although Johnny swore up and down that the little one had a real diamond in it.
"Now hold out his hands."
I did, and Johnny poured a cap of lye over the tip of each finger. That was one set of prints wasn't ever going to come back. Then he leaned over Jack's face and kissed him on the forehead.
"I hate to do this, Red, but I know you'd do the same to me if it had gone the other way."
He then poured the lye over Jack's cheeks and mouth and brow. It hissed and bubbled and turned white. When it started to eat through his closed eyelids, I turned away. And of course, none of it done no good. The body was found by a farmer after a load of gravel. A pack of dogs had knocked away most of the stones we covered him with and were eating what was left of his hands and face. As for the rest of him, there were enough scars for the cops to ID him as Jack Hamilton. It was the end of Johnny's luck, all right. Every move he made after that, right up to the night Purvis and his badge-carrying Gunsels got him at the Biograph, was a bad one. Could he have just thrown up his hands that night and surrendered? I'd have to say no. Purvis meant to have him dead one way or the other. That's why the G's never told the Chicago cops Johnny was in town. I'll never forget the way Jack laughed when I brought them flies in on their strings. He was a good fella. They all were, mostly, good fellas who got into the wrong line of work. And Johnny was the best of the bunch. No man ever had a truer friend. We robbed one more bank together, the Merchants National in South Bend, Indiana. Lester Nelson joined us on that caper. Getting out of town, it seemed like every hick in Indiana was throwing lead at us, and we still got away. But for what? We'd been expecting more than $100,000, enough to move to Mexico and live like kings. We ended up with a lousy $20,000, most of it in dimes and dirty dollar bills. God makes it all come right in the end. That's what Johnny told Doc Barker just before we parted company. I was raised a Christian. I admit I fell away a bit along my journey. And I believe that. We're stuck with what we have, but that's all right. In God's eyes, none of us are really much more than flies on strings. And all that matters is how much sunshine you can spread along the way. The last time I seen Johnny Dillinger was in Chicago, and he was laughing at something I said. That's good enough for me.
In the Death Room, read by Stephen King.
In the Death Room. It was a death room. Fletcher knew it for what it was as soon as the door opened. The floor was gray industrial tile. The walls were discolored white stone, marked here and there with darker patches that might have been blood. Certainly blood had been spilled in this room. The overhead lights were cupped in wire cages. Halfway across the room stood a long wooden table with three people seated behind it. Before the table was an empty chair, waiting for Fletcher. Beside the chair stood a small wheeled trolley. The object on it had been draped with a piece of cloth, as a sculptor might cover his work in progress between sessions. Fletcher was half led, half dragged toward the chair which had been placed for him. He reeled in the guard's grip and let himself reel. If he looked more dazed than he really was, more shocked and unthinking, that was fine. He thought his chances of ever leaving this basement room in the Ministry of Information were perhaps 1 or 2 in 30, and perhaps that was optimistic. Whatever they were, he had no intention of thinning them further by looking even halfway alert. His swelled eyes, puffy nose, and broken lower lip might help in this regard. So might the crust of blood, like a dark red goatee, around his mouth. One thing Fletcher knew for sure. If he didn't leave, the others, the guard and the three sitting in tribunal behind the table, would be dead. He was a newspaper reporter and had never killed anything much larger than a hornet, but if he had to kill to escape this room, he would. He thought of his sister on her retreat. He thought of his sister swimming in a river with a Spanish name. He thought of the light on the water at noon, moving river light too bright to look at. They reached the chair in front of the table. The guard pushed him into it so hard that Fletcher almost tipped himself over. "Careful now. That's not the way. No accidents," said one of the men behind the table. It was Escobar. He spoke to the guard in Spanish. To Escobar's left sat another man. To Escobar's right sat a woman of about 60. The woman and the other man were thin. Escobar was fat and as greasy as a cheap candle. He looked like a movie Mexican. You expected him to say, "Baches? Baches? We don't need no stinking baches." Yet this was the chief minister of information. Sometimes he gave the English language portion of the weather on the city television station. When he did this, he invariably got fan mail. In a suit, he didn't look greasy, just roly-poly. Fletcher knew all this. He had done 3 or 4 stories on Escobar. He was colorful. He was also, according to rumor, an enthusiastic torturer. A Central American Himmler, Fletcher thought, and was amazed to discover that one sense of humor, rudimentary, granted, could function this far into a state of terror. "Handcuffs?" the guard asked, also in Spanish, and held up a pair of the plastic kind. Fletcher tried to keep his look of dazed incomprehension. If they cuffed him, it was over. He could forget about 1 chance in 30, or 1 in 300. Escobar turned briefly to the woman on his right. Her face was very dark, her hair black with startling white streaks. It flowed back and up from her forehead as if blown by a gale-force wind. The look of her hair reminded Fletcher of Elsa Lanchester in The Bride of Frankenstein. He gripped this similarity with a fierceness that was close to panic, the way he gripped the thought of bright light on the river, or his sister laughing with her friends as they walked to the water. He wanted images, not ideas. Images were luxury items now, and ideas were no good in a place like this. In a place like this, all you got were the wrong ideas. The woman gave Escobar a small nod. Fletcher had seen her around the building, always garbed in shapeless dresses like the one she wore now. She had been with Escobar often enough for Fletcher to assume she was his secretary, personal assistant, perhaps even his biographer. Christ knew that